Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
The first degree.
You see it on the paper. You see it on Facebook.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
Things just didn't add up. Like, the blood spatter. I mean, there was blood in the room, but it just wasn't a lot. And you know, considering the extent of the sustained wounds, it was like, I mean, I would imagine there to have been a lot more. In addition to the fact that I don't see how someone who inflicted so many wounds on their body could pull the covers up over them. And dead people don't move.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting here with Alexis Linkletter. Hello, Lex.
Hello, Jack.
How are you feeling on this fine Wednesday?
I'm feeling riveted because this is an episode, and this is a two-part series that I think will perplex and baffle and probably outrage many people who are listening.
Yeah, this is one of the craziest, most confusing, like, what is going on kind of cases that we've done in a long time. Obviously, it is a two-parter if you click to listen on our podcast. If you want to listen to everything together, you can listen to our Patreon, all of our multi-parters. We just throw all the way on Patreon, but we should get right into it because this, you're going to be mind blown.
Right. And we have a lot to cover.
All right. We have a lot to cover. So that is enough of that. So let's turn on the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
In the realm of true crime, there are instances when the official story feels off, no matter how neatly packaged it all appears. It's like reality itself is nudging us, whispering doubts in our ears. You know that sensation when something just doesn't sit right, something just doesn't feel right. It's unsettling, isn't it? It's in these moments that we start questioning, peeling back the layers of deception. And today we're diving into one such case where the pieces of the puzzle just refuse to fit. And the truth remains veiled in darkness, in confusion, and in heartbreak. That instinct, that gut feeling, it's present here, and it's trying to tell us there's more lurking beneath the surface.
Today's case begins on January 4th of 2001. We're only 4 days into the new year, and it was National Spaghetti Day. The top song on the charts was Independent Women Part 1 by Destiny's Child, and other songs included It Wasn't Me by Shaggy and With Arms Wide Open by Creed. Good time for music.
Good time for music.
The number one movie in theaters was What Women Want, with Miss Congeniality following at number two.
And the setting for today's case is the University of California, Davis, also known as UC Davis or just plain Davis. And the university is located in Davis, California, which is just outside of Sacramento. And UC Davis was founded in 1908 and was originally called University Farm. As you can imagine, based on the name, the original university focused on agriculture, which is where the college gets their athletics name, the Aggies. And fun fact, their mascot is Gunrock the Mustang, which is based on a real thoroughbred racehorse named Gunrock, who once lived at the university.
And we have two first degrees for today's case, and we're going to start with introducing you to Megan. When she was 3 years old, she and her family moved to Eureka, California, a coastal city in Northern California located around 5 hours from Davis. Once they were settled in Eureka, Megan's family started attending a local church, and that's how they met the Weeman family, which was made up of parents Wesley and Jan and their sons Andrew and Daniel. We were also able to speak to Daniel for this episode, who you're going to hear from pretty soon. Megan was friends with both brothers and was especially close to Andrew.
He is 3 years younger than me was. And so we were almost in different groups, but like at the same time, our groups overlapped age-wise. So we grew up together, basically every single church event, 3 days a week, 4 days a week. We went camping every single summer. He's just a fixture in my growing up. Our parents were best friends and his best friends were also all my, like we all just were a core group that just grew up together. I thought I was going to marry the guy. He was like my soulmate. But of course, I was 16. What do I know?
Andrew Vernon Weeman was born on June 19th, 1980 in California. He was known for being friendly, caring, and outgoing.
He was very well liked. He was super popular. His dad's a dentist. You know, they were super involved in church. He was a golden boy. He was like your boy next door. He was very popular. Everybody loves him. He's a great, great, great guy.
While attending high school in Eureka, Andrew did really well. School just kind of came naturally to him, and he was always a straight-A student. His peers described him as a perfectionist, a high achiever, and a leader. He was goal-oriented and anxious to succeed. But on the other hand, he was able to balance work, school, and of course, some fun. He always lived life to the fullest, and he was a total joy to be around.
After graduating fifth in his class, Andrew enrolled at UC Davis, where he majored in managerial economics and minored in Spanish. He remained close to his parents and brother, visiting and calling home on a regular basis. Andrew eventually became a member of the Kappa Sigma fraternity. And at the start of his junior year, in the fall of 2000, he moved into their on-campus house. And he also became the fraternity's treasurer. Kappa Sigma, commonly nicknamed Kappa Sig, is an international fraternity with 282 active chapters and colonies in North America. Kappa Sigma has been one of the oldest fraternities at UC Davis.
And Andrew's fraternity brothers recalled how intelligent he really was, and they even referred to him as the smartest guy in the house. He was getting straight A's, was fluent in Spanish, and even had plans to attend a semester abroad in Spain. The frat brothers also noticed how social Andrew was. He was super involved in campus and had a lot of friends.
For the Christmas holiday in December of 2000, Andrew went back home to Eureka. Of course, his parents and brother were really glad to see him. They had a nice visit, and just before New Year's Day, Andrew returned back to campus. On Thursday, January 4th of 2001, Andrew was supposed to attend the first day of nutrition class, which began at 10:30 a.m. But he never showed up, which was something completely out of character for Andrew.
So when Andrew didn't go to the first day of this class, his fraternity brother James became worried. He was especially concerned because he hadn't actually seen Andrew since the second. At around 1 p.m., James headed back to the fraternity house after class and went straight to Andrew's room on the second floor, which is dorm number 12. He knocked on the door, but there was no response and the door was locked. It was the type of lock that required either a key from the outside or a turn of the deadbolt knob from the inside.
James decided to go to the company that managed the fraternity house to obtain the master key, which would give him access to Andrew's room. And after securing the key, three fraternity brothers, including James, entered Andrew's room. Inside, the lights were off, and the blinds were drawn, and music was playing. James noticed Andrew was lying on his bed, face down and underneath a comforter. He wasn't moving, and he had blood on his face.
James ran to another room where several other fraternity brothers had gathered, and they said that they needed to call an ambulance stat. Two different brothers entered Andrew's room to check for a pulse, and that's when they realized that Andrew's wrists had knife injuries on them.
The fraternity brothers left the room, and one of them dialed 911. Paramedics arrived and pronounced Andrew dead at 1:20. The paramedics then exited the room and waited for the UC Davis police and the coroner to arrive.
When the coroner arrived, they made some early observations and found that in addition to the two cut wrists, he actually had more than 24 stab wounds to his head, his chest, and his neck. When the coroner looked around the room, they found what appeared to be a suicide note sitting on Andrew's desk. A few hours later, the deputy coroner went to Andrew's parents' house in Eureka and delivered the tragic news. Here's Andrew's younger brother, Daniel, explaining what happened next.
I'll never forget the day when the Humboldt County Sheriff Coroners came to our house. You know, I'd maybe been home for about 30, 40 minutes. I had just gotten like a new backpack. You know, I was kind of happy. It was the second semester of my senior year of high school. And I see these cops at the front door. And I was like, oh, crap. You know, actually, in my mind, I'm thinking like, oh, shit, did I get one of those silent tickets? And they're here to like, give me a ticket? Like, did I speed through a light? I didn't even see that it said coroner on the side. I saw a police vehicle. And, you know, I was like, hey, mama, you know, these people want to talk to you. I was like really nervous. I think it was so strange to me how the coroner's office presented, you know, that Andrew was dead. I think they said to her that he had been found dead and had committed suicide.
The coroner didn't tell Andrew's family about the extensive amount of stab wounds that Andrew had suffered. But even without all of the details, his family didn't believe for a second that Andrew had taken his own life. So that begs the question, what really happened to Andrew Weeman? And why would the deputy coroner tell the family that Andrew had completed suicide, even though he had dozens of stab wounds and a full investigation hadn't been carried out yet? To answer all these questions and more, you know the drill. We got to go back.
So let's start with what the coroner and UC Davis police saw when they got to Andrew's dorm room in the fraternity house. When they entered the room, which showed no signs of forced entry, they noticed a sweaty odor. Andrew, who was in full rigor mortis, was lying on his bed, which was in the far right corner of his bedroom at the conjunction of the north and east walls. He was on his stomach, with a sheet and comforter covering him up to his mid-chest, both tucked underneath him.
Andrew's head was positioned at the top of the bed, turned towards the left and resting on a pillow. He was lying on his right arm, which was extended past his left shoulder, exposing his forearm, wrists, and hand above the bedding. His left arm was bent at the elbow and tucked beneath his body. His legs were stretched out to the end of the bed.
Andrew had a total of 29 knife wounds on his body, which according to police reports were all dry. There were 25 stab wounds and 4 incised wounds all over Andrew's face, scalp, neck, chest, and wrists. Later during the autopsy, they found that 2 of these wounds, a gaping wound to his neck and through his heart, were fatal. There were no injuries to his back.
The coroner's office noted that Andrew was wearing a long-sleeved shirt, which had visible knife holes and blood corresponding with the stab wounds. A long blonde hair was recovered from the shoulder area of Andrew's shirt, near the neckline, which was determined to be foreign to Andrew. The reports don't say whose hair this was. He was also wearing shorts, socks, a ring, a necklace, and earplugs, something he often wore to help him sleep in the noisy dorm.
Both of Andrew's socks had blood stains on the bottom, top of the foot, and the ankle. Round blood stains on the top of the socks were consistent with Andrew having been in an upright position when he was stabbed, while the blood stains on the bottom of the socks could have come from him stepping on wet blood. And Andrew's shorts had numerous blood stains which came from both contact smears and soaking.
A black-handled, single-edged hunting-style knife was on the bed next to Andrew's left elbow. The tip of the knife was broken. And this knife tip was never located. It was later determined that the knife did belong to Andrew. However, authorities never figured out how or when the tip of the knife was damaged.
Andrew's bedding was covered in blood. Some smear drops were found on the lower portion of the comforter, which suggested movement of either the comforter or the blood source before drying. None of the bedding or pillows had any knife holes. There was one long blonde hair and a short curled reddish hair on the comforter, which did not belong to Andrew. And again, the police reports did not say who left those hairs.
There was blood found throughout the room as well, specifically on the north, east, and south walls. The blood patterns on the walls consisted of fabric prints, drips, and smears. There were also blood stains with thin, closely spaced parallel lines, which were consistent with Andrew's long-sleeved shirt. These blood stains were on the south and east walls, on one of the pillowcases, on the computer desktop, on the telephone, on the desk, and on top of a Nike shoe.
There were other types of blood stains throughout the room as well. On Andrew's computer desktop and shelf, on the computer mouse, the computer speaker knobs, and on the base of his landline phone. An Aquafina water bottle found on the floor near a small fridge also had blood on it, as did a rug in the room. In addition to all of this blood, there was a standing white pole lamp, which looked disturbed, as though it had been knocked over and was leaning against the wall. It appeared to be blood-stained at the light switch height and the kneecap height.
Then there was a mirror near the lamp, which was broken. Glass fragments were lying on the carpet directly below the mirror. Also below the mirror was a houseplant. It was blood-stained and had broken leaves. The rest of the room appeared to be neat and tidy. There was a shelf on the western and northern walls, several feet above the bed, with bottles and pictures displayed on it, which were undisturbed.
On top of a computer desk located to the left of Andrew's bed was a handwritten note, and it read, "Dear world, I am only doing this because I have no other choice. I can no longer take care of myself, and I don't want others to have to do it for me. I can't tell what is wrong or right anymore, and I don't want to hurt anyone. Thank you all for loving me. I hope to see you in heaven." The note was signed Andrew with a heart drawn to the left of his name. So this note was sent off for testing to determine if Andrew actually really wrote it himself. And Andrew's family does not believe that he wrote this letter willfully if it was him.
Andrew's wallet was found next to the letter, with his cash and credit card still inside. On the desk was a computer, like we've mentioned, which was on and playing music through the speakers. Andrew's keys were near a backpack on the floor. And finally, the last thing noted in the files was that a Bible was found on the floor next to the bed. There was a bookmark in the Bible, marking a particular section that is often cited to encourage the, quote, suffering Christian, and to offer assurance of God's grace.
When the coroner's office and UC Davis police were done looking through Andrew's room, the UC Davis police ruled Andrew's death as a suicide. However, coroner's officials classified his death as suspicious due to the number of stab wounds.
The public immediately took interest in Andrew's case, and it became very high profile very quickly. So the UC Davis police decided to turn to another agency for help. Ultimately, the California Department of Justice was contacted to help with the investigation, which meant that three agencies in total would have a hand in investigating what happened to Andrew, and each agency took on different roles. So UC Davis police handled interviews, and the county coroner's office conducted the autopsy and also conducted some interviews themselves. Then, the California Department of Justice analyzed physical evidence and compiled a psychological profile of Andrew, which I would assume would be very hard to do if he's not there.
Yeah.
So you're getting a secondhand psychological profile based on other people's perceptions. It's just, yeah. I'm not sure what good that would do anyone, frankly.
Interestingly, UC Davis staff didn't inform students that there had been a death on campus for a full 24 hours. And when they did finally make an announcement, they said that Andrew had likely completed suicide. However, the UC Davis police came out and said that suicide hadn't been determined. So we're kind of getting different things from the different people. They noted that Andrew's death was suspicious, and that's all they knew so far. So it's worth noting that these agencies didn't appear to be aligned on the most important aspects of the case.
The investigation into how Andrew died continued, with his roommates and loved ones being interviewed. Law enforcement needed to learn as much about Andrew as they could in an effort to determine what happened. During these interviews, the police learned that when Andrew was home for the Christmas 2000 holidays, he appeared, quote, worried. I'm not sure what I worry pretty much 24/7. So I hate to insert my opinion every time something like this comes up, but all of these things we're about to discuss, these things that were noted in his behavior, just seem like normal, angsty,
yeah,
college student feelings, right? So they also noted here that he also seemed to be more tired than usual and was possibly suffering from insomnia. Okay.
Yeah, same.
Right. Now, these changes could have been occurring because apparently Andrew was struggling with his career choice. And apparently he talked to his family about wanting to change his major to something more fun than managerial economics. He still wanted to study Spanish abroad, though, and he was making plans to do so in the coming semester. So I don't know. I think having the choice to change your major and deciding whether or not you want to doesn't sound something that would cause that much emotional turmoil. I mean, what do I know, though?
Yeah. I mean, everybody is obviously different. But, you know, if you're not looking back retroactively and trying to pinpoint some of these things, they're kind of things you wouldn't have even thought about probably with your son.
100%. It wouldn't even make you worried.
Yeah.
It's just normal, like coming into your adult age confusion.
Absolutely. So during this Christmas visit, Andrew's parents took him shopping to try to help him relax and brighten his spirits up a little bit. Then on December 30th, Andrew returned to campus with his best friend, Ryan, who wasn't actually a UC Davis student, but he was just there to visit, be a friend, etc.
Right. And Andrew's girlfriend of around 3 months, whose name was Jennifer, told the police that she spoke to Andrew that afternoon. And during their conversation, Andrew apparently talked to a friend who had become sick after taking ecstasy, and that's something they discussed. So Andrew, who was known to drink and smoke weed occasionally and recreationally as a college student, then told Jennifer, quote, "I'm so sick of drinking and smoking." The following day, Andrew and Ryan left for South Lake Tahoe to celebrate New Year's with 12 other fraternity brothers and friends.
After getting to Lake Tahoe, the group began drinking beer, vodka, and rum at around 7 p.m. They stayed up most of the night partying, which would be typical behavior for college students and fraternity brothers. When questioned, Ryan told the police that Andrew drank quite a bit, but he didn't seem to have a good time and was quieter than usual. Then at around 3 p.m. the next day, Andrew and Ryan returned to UC Davis.
After getting back to the fraternity house, Ryan and Andrew, who were both hungover, decided to take a nap. Ryan slept on the floor while Andrew slept on the bed. Ryan told the police that when he woke up, Andrew was leaning over the side of the bed and staring at him. Ryan asked Andrew what was wrong, and Andrew told him that he couldn't sleep. A few hours later, Ryan left to drive back to UC Santa Cruz, where he was going to school.
Not long after Ryan left, Andrew called his parents and told them about his New Year's trip and that he enjoyed his time in Tahoe with his friends. Andrew's mother told the police that they also discussed his plans to study Spanish abroad in Europe. After getting off the phone with his parents, Andrew hung out with the only other people in the fraternity house at that time, which were his frat brothers, Danny and James. They watched football, and later, at around 9 p.m., they went to Andrew's room to hang out there.
At around 1 a.m., on what was now January 2nd, Andrew told the guys that he was going to bed. He went to his room, and no one ever saw him again. James and Danny told the police that that night, they slept in Danny's room, which was next door to Andrew's room. And when asked, James said he heard a sound at his door as he slept, but he didn't get up to investigate what was going on at any point.
During the daylight hours of January 2nd, there were 5 people in the home aside from Andrew. Everybody was surprised that they didn't see Andrew that day, whose car was parked in the parking lot. Danny told the police that he checked Andrew's door late in the afternoon and found it locked. Other people in the house also knocked on Andrew's door and yelled out his name, but they received no answer.
Then on January 3rd, Danny tried the door handle to Andrew's room yet again, and it was still locked. Other fraternity brothers walked by Andrew's room on the same day and either banged on his door or yelled at his name, and again, they received no answers. Then on the 4th, Andrew was supposed to go to that nutrition class but didn't show up. That's when he was found by his fraternity brothers.
And during interviews with Andrew's fraternity brothers, friends, and family, the police learned that Andrew had never once mentioned being suicidal or even depressed. Everybody said that Andrew was very smart and easygoing and seemed to have a really good life. The police also learned a little bit more about Andrew's habits. Andrew's best friend Ryan said that Andrew never locked his door. However, his fraternity brother said that he did lock his door while he was sleeping or away from the house. Ryan also mentioned hearing a rumor that somebody was driving Andrew's car before his death, but it is unclear whether the police actually looked into this rumor further.
On January 5th, one day after Andrew had been found, an autopsy was conducted. The pathologist found that there were a total of 29 wounds to Andrew's body, 25 of which were stab wounds, and 4 were incised wounds. 2 of the wounds to Andrew's neck and chest were characterized as fatal, as we said earlier, and they were determined to be the cause of death.
So let's break down exactly where these wounds were located. There were 5 stab wounds to Andrew's upper chest, and these wounds penetrated both lungs and the heart. The one to Andrew's heart was fatal. There were 4 additional stab wounds grouped in the lower chest, and that's a total of 9 stab wounds to Andrew's whole chest.
And there were 2 stab wounds to the left side of Andrew's neck. There was an area of abrasion above one of these wounds. On the front part of the neck, there was a deep incised wound, which was a 2nd fatal injury. There were no hesitation marks associated with this wound. So a hesitation mark is kind of what it sounds like. If someone's doing a quick, swift jab with a weapon without hesitation, meaning they're not feeling anything when it's happening, the person being stabbed is.
Yeah.
If you were stabbing yourself, you would expect to see a hesitation wound because of
the pain.
The pain you're experiencing, just like your biological reaction to pain.
Right.
That's what you'd expect to see. So in total, after that aside, there's a total of 3 stab wounds to Andrew's neck.
When it came to Andrew's face, there were 5 superficial stab wounds to the right temple, 5 to the left temple, 1 to the forehead, and 1 to the right side of his chin. 2 small stab wounds were found over the vertex of his scalp, which is the highest point on your scalp towards the back of your head. That is a total of 14 wounds to Andrew's face and his head.
A stab wound towards the back of your head is strange.
And difficult to.
Difficult to do to yourself. So in addition to all of these wounds, both of Andrew's wrists had horizontal incised wounds, and there were abrasions on the 3rd and 4th fingers on Andrew's right hand. On the 2nd finger on the right hand, there was a small horizontal incised wound and an abrasion, and the right thumb had a superficial abrasion too.
The pathologist found no evidence of blunt force trauma, torture, bindings, or sexual assault. There were no injuries to Andrew's nose, mouth, tongue, teeth, or ears, and no bruising, fracture, or trauma to his bones. The toxicology report also showed no traces of alcohol or drugs in Andrew's system.
Which is a key component here.
Yeah.
The staggering number of wounds Andrew suffered begs so many questions. You try to imagine the state one would have had to be in to do something like this to yourself, seemingly unprompted. And obviously, the first place your mind goes is assuming drugs and alcohol have to be involved in this somehow. But just like Jack said, that's not the case. Then your mind goes to thinking someone would have had to be in literal psychosis to do something like this to themselves. But Andrew had no history of mental illness whatsoever, not even depression. This is all highly suspicious. As a result, in the end, the medical examiner was unable to determine Andrew's manner of death, which is kind of a fair assessment, really.
Yeah.
What they did know was that Andrew's death was suspicious, and he had been dead for more than 12 hours by the time he was discovered. Consequently, authorities continued their investigation to try to determine the circumstances surrounding what happened.
On January 5th, the coroner's office revealed to the public that Andrew's cause of death was stab wounds to the neck and chest. The office was clear about not knowing the manner of death just yet. Despite this, the UC Davis campus spokeswoman again said that Andrew may have completed suicide. Meanwhile, the UC Davis police told the public that the supposed suicide note was still being analyzed and the manner of death hadn't been determined. Shock over Andrew's death permeated through the UC Davis campus, and rumors and speculation that Andrew had actually been murdered began immediately.
Andrew's family and fraternity brothers told the media that they didn't believe Andrew had taken his own life. They pointed to the number of stab wounds and questioned if he would have even been able to inflict the fatal wounds to his heart and neck at all. Andrew's grandfather told the Sacramento Bee, quote, "It just doesn't add up. He was in good spirits when we saw him over the holidays. There was absolutely no indication that anything was wrong.
Things just didn't add up. Like, the blood spatter. I mean, there was blood in the room, but it just wasn't a lot. And, you know, considering the extent of the sustained wounds, it was like, I mean, I would imagine there to have been a lot more. In addition to the fact that I don't see how someone who inflicted so many wounds on their body could pull the covers up over them, and dead people don't move.
Just imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials. Just imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach. We're talking things like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for just $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And listen to this, the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. We love that. And besides having incredible luxury clothing items like cashmere sweaters, they also have awesome housewares. But this cashmere sweater that I got from Quince, I get so many compliments on it, and I paid significantly less than I would almost anywhere else. It's time to indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/first for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince, quince.com/first to get free shipping and 365-day return. That's quince.com/first.
Okay, so it comes as no surprise that I have absolutely no idea how to cook. I don't want to learn how to cook. It's not really my thing. But when I tried Factor Meals, it was a freaking game changer. So Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Yeah, 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. So the first time I tried Factor Meals, I was actually blown away because I'm like, that's it. That's all it is. 2 minutes. And the meals are so delicious. With 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every single week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. And you can treat yourself to restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon. Ooh, fancy. Shrimp and blackened salmon. Like I said, they're so easy to prepare. I love them. So head to factormeals.com/degree50 and use code degree50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code degree50 at factormeals.com/degree50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
It's almost summer, and the best and most sustainable way to shop for a new season is on therealreal.com. The RealReal is the largest and most trusted source for authenticated luxury resale. It's the only place you'll find brands like Hermes, Cartier, Prada, Dior, Staud, Zimmermann, Jacquemus, and more for up to 90% off retail. 10,000 plus new arrivals land every single day from hundreds of brands you love, all authenticated by a team of in-house experts. Whether it's that perfect wedding guest look, a new summer sandal, an updated beach tote, resort wear for your summer vacation, you're bound to find exactly what you're looking for, plus deals you won't get anywhere else on TheRealReal.com. Visit TheRealReal.com and use code FIRST at checkout for 20% off. Terms apply. If you're a wine lover, here's a little secret. There's a personalized wine club that has amazing wines and exclusive perks. It's called First Leaf. As a First Leaf member, you get to discover new wines you're guaranteed to love. To start, answer a few questions on their website about what flavors you like, how often you drink wine, and if you prefer red, white, or rosé. Based on your answers, First Leaf curates an amazing selection of wines just for you. Later, when you rate those wines, your wine selection gets even more tailored. Choose when the wine is delivered and how often to get new assortments of wine. Being part of First Leaf Wine Club also has perks. As a member, you get access to their helpful wine concierge. If you want wine pairing advice or to talk about the wines in your box, you can always speak with one of their experts. Plus, you get member-exclusive pricing on every order. I love every time I get my First Leaf shipment. It always has a multitude of wines I've been dying to try, but too nervous to select because I don't know what I'm doing with wine. You get a rosé, you get a white, you get a red, and you get to try everything. Delivery is simple. Picking out the wine you want is simple. It's a no-brainer. Join the club today and discover new wines you'll love with First Leaf. Go to tryfirstleaf.com/firstdegree to get your first box. That's tryfirstleaf.com/firstdegree. tryfirstleaf.com/firstdegree.
Over the next week and a half, the investigation continued, and the media kept questioning whether it was possible for Andrew's death to be a suicide. Again, things just were not adding up. On January 16th, it was announced that the California Department of Justice had confirmed the handwriting on the Dear World note was in fact Andrew's. According to the police reports, it was the examiner's opinion that the note was not written under duress. The examiner also noted the absence of indented writings on the note, which would typically indicate that a second note had been written on top of it.
So I wanted to just take a moment to actually talk about handwriting analysis in general, because people who I've discussed this case with point to the note as the most obvious reason this has to be considered a suicide, right? Mm-hmm. So experts actually disagree on the validity of handwriting analysis in terms of forensic evidence and the evidentiary value. Some believe that writing analysis can be legitimate, while others think it's subjective, too subjective, or junk science. And there's more. So the exact error rate for forensic examination of handwriting analysis in documents doesn't exist. So we don't know how often people are wrong when they make these determinations. And according to a paper published in PNAS, I think it's PNAS, P-N-A-S. I don't know how people talk about it, but it's one of the world's most cited and comprehensive multidisciplinary scientific journals. So they published this paper. And in the paper, they said the scientific basis for handwriting comparisons needs to be strengthened, noting that there has been only limited research to quantify the reliability and replicability of the practices used by trained document examiners. So where I'm going with this is that I think we should be skeptical about the note only because, I mean, I think handwriting analysis has gotten better, and I'm sure there's actually algorithms and things you can do with it now. Mm-hmm. They probably put it in a computer. Who knows what you can do with AI, but this was in 2001. So it probably was a bit more archaic. So it's just something to put in your mind.
And in recent years, studies to determine the effectiveness of handwriting analysis have been conducted by organizations like the FBI. And some of the studies suggest that highly trained handwriting experts were effective in correctly identifying and matching handwriting. But it's difficult to know for sure without knowing all of the variables involved in the study.
Right. Either way, despite the results of the note coming back as allegedly having, quote, been written by Andrew, the police continue to say they still weren't sure of Andrew's manner of death, which I think also says something. It's like, you've sent this note off to be analyzed. They come back and tell you it is in fact Andrew's, but you're still not really willing to determine that this is a suicide. So they're obviously right. Looking at some things here that really make them think otherwise, or at least have given them pause.
Right.
So more tests needed to be done as a result. So their plan was then to conduct a fingerprint analysis on the note and the knife, which they hoped could provide more answers.
And by this point, the Weeman family didn't really know much more than the public knew. They believed their son had been murdered, but the police offered them absolutely no insights, leaving them with endless questions and concerns. Andrew's dad, Wesley, told the media, "The situation was hard enough, and not knowing anything made it even more difficult." Frustrated and desperate for answers, the family hired an attorney to help obtain information about Andrew's death from the police. They also announced a $10,000 reward for any information leading to Andrew's killer.
Then, on January 23rd, authorities held a press conference to give updates on Andrew's case. They revealed that fingerprints found on the knife and the note were from Andrew and no one else. They didn't announce this at the conference, but we know from the police reports that DNA analysis was also performed on numerous items, including blood samples from the knife blade and handle, the walls, the desk, and clothes found in the room. So the blood from all of these items matched Andrew, and only Andrew. Additionally, blood recovered from Andrew's fingernail scrapings and cuttings matched only Andrew. So even with these findings, the police said they still weren't sure about Andrew's manner of death.
And because the family wasn't getting any answers from the police, they contacted Dr. Cooper, a forensic pathologist who conducted a second autopsy. However, he faced significant challenges as he wasn't allowed access to evidence from the initial autopsy, and Andrew's body had already been embalmed, complicating things even further. Despite these obstacles, Dr. Cooper conducted the autopsy and came to a much different conclusion than the first pathologist.
I know that we paid for our own forensic pathologist to examine Andrew's body. And the consensus was that he's like, you can rest that your son did not do this to himself.
Dr. Cooper specifically wrote in his report, quote, "Any speculation that this may have been a suicide is patently incongruous with the pattern of injury observed at autopsy. On the contrary, postmortem examination of Andrew Weeman's body reveals conclusively and compellingly that he was killed by one or more assailants and that he did not take his own life. Further, autopsy evidence indicates that prolonged detainment and torture occurred over a period of several hours, despite an absence of specific evidence of restraint at second autopsy at any rate."
Dr. Cooper believed that the injuries to Andrew's fingers on his right hand were defensive wounds. He also found an area of bruising to the right temple, which he found to be consistent with blunt force trauma. He also noted the numerous abrasions and scratches on Andrew's upper chest, upper abdomen, and face, which weren't noted in the first autopsy. Dr. Cooper also determined that the cut to Andrew's left wrist had occurred at least 12 hours before he died, and significantly earlier than when the right wrist was cut.
In the end, Dr. Cooper concluded that Andrew was killed by an assailant or assailants wielding a knife, and that he was held captive for some time, and several hours prior to his death, he sustained a blow to the right side of the head, a cut to the left wrist, and superficial stab wounds to the face. He eventually sustained multiple stab wounds to the chest, a cut to the right wrist, And it appears that he was ultimately killed with a cut across his throat. Dr. Cooper wrote, "The perpetrator or perpetrators made an effort to conceal the crime by disguising it as a suicide."
Following the second autopsy, Dr. Cooper spoke at a press conference where he said, "There was a conclusive, compelling evidence that it was a homicide. I told the family that they should dismiss the idea that it was suicide." And unfortunately, Dr. Cooper's findings carried no official weight in the investigation. So authorities kept calling Andrew's death suspicious and said that their investigation would continue.
Right, and there were scant updates from the police over the next 5 months. According to the police reports, during this time, authorities were still trying to figure out Andrew's manner of death. They contacted suicide prevention and crisis services to figure out if Andrew had made any calls to them. He hadn't. The police also tried to locate psychological records from UC Davis, but Andrew did not seek any services at the counseling center, so there weren't any.
Next, a suicide prevention coordinator was interviewed. She told police that, in her opinion, the suicide note was a global message not intended for just one person, but seemingly more for everybody to see. According to the police reports, the coordinator said at first, when she was told about Andrew's death, the number of wounds seemed unusual. But once it was evident that most of the wounds were superficial, it didn't seem as strange to her.
Stating that most of Andrew's wounds were superficial seems kind of inaccurate. So two of the wounds were fatal. Two, not one. Of these two wounds, there was a gash across the neck, which showed zero hesitation, as we discussed. And the other stab wounds penetrated his heart and both lungs. That seems far from superficial. And this coordinator who was interviewed also told the police that in many suicides where head wounds were involved, the individual causing the damage to themselves typically is having auditory hallucinations and hearing voices. Therefore, they try to remove the voices in their head by causing damage to that area. So she suggested that Andrew might have been schizophrenic or in a schizophrenic type state.
This woman that made that statement never even met him. She was just someone that they consulted as an expert in suicide and why somebody who was suicidal might have stabbed themselves in the head. My issue is he was stabbed 29 times and three of them were fatal. And then he supposedly climbed onto his bed, pulled the covers up to his neck and tucked them underneath him. That's what they said, that the covers were pulled up to his neck and that they were tucked under him. You're telling me he stabbed himself 29 times? And if you're right-handed, which he is, why are you going to stab both sides of your head? I mean, I don't know what happens when you hear voices. I've never experienced that. But he never had a single, any kind of, you know, mental illness. I'm sure he had his bouts of depression or whatever, like anybody does, or stress. Whatever he was going through, something was really stressing him out. But he never had any history of mental illness.
When reporting on Andrew's death, the Sacramento Bee reached out to psychiatrists and criminologists, and they all said that the deep slashes on Andrew's body could be self-inflicted only by somebody psychotic or made temporarily psychotic by drugs and alcohol. Yet, like we said, there were no drugs or no alcohol in Andrew's system, and Andrew had zero history of mental illness.
Right, and these are professionals saying, oh, that only occurs when. I mean, yeah. For someone to do that kind of damage and keep going is wild.
Yeah.
So by late June of that year, authorities still hadn't concluded Andrew's manner of death. His parents told the Sacramento Bee that they were worried the case had stalled, or worse, that the campus hadn't been conducting a thorough homicide investigation at all. Andrew's father, Wesley, asked, "Why aren't they doing more to find out who did it? I felt from the beginning that the police would do their best to cover it up. I've remained silent for a long time. I'm tired of being nice."
As you can imagine, dealing with the police and media was really difficult for Andrew's parents, who were still reeling from the heartache of losing their son.
I think my parents, unfortunately, like at the time, it was a lot for them. They were interviewed and pressed for information so much more than I was. And so they got the brunt of interviews and press releases and conversations with like the private investigator, the Yolo County Sheriff's Department, and the UC Davis Police Department.
After hearing what Andrew's parents said, the UC Davis spokesman told the Sacramento Bee that detectives had spent hundreds of hours on this case. They said, quote, "No way is there a cover-up. We know the family is frustrated and would like to know more, but we can't release more because it could jeopardize our investigation." The police further said that Andrew's death was among the most complex they had ever encountered. Ever encountered. It was so complex that there was a possibility they wouldn't ever be able to determine his manner of death. And my question is, if they believed it was probably a suicide, why are they dumping hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours into this investigation?
Yeah.
And why are they withholding information from the family? Because usually under those circumstances, if they really believe it to be a suicide, why weren't they more open?
Yeah.
Just a thought.
Just a thought. So this all was, of course, very upsetting to the Weeman family. And Andrew's mother told the Sacramento Bee, "This has been such a horrible, emotionally draining process since the coroner's officials came to our door. We know nothing will get him back, but we do want answers."
And there were a few articles about Andrew's death until February of 2002. At that point, 13 months had passed since Andrew was found unresponsive in his fraternity dorm room. Then, on February 10th, the coroner's office announced that a conclusion in Andrew's manner of death had in fact been made, finally. And they said, after reviewing all of the evidence, their determination was that Andrew's case was that of suicide.
News headlines about the contradictions in the case circulated and demonstrated how invested the public had become in the outcome. One headline said, "Suicide, coroner describes case as very complex." Another said, "Suicide, the family still has questions." And another read, "Student death is still a mystery." Followed by, "Student slain, family experts say." And pathologist hired by family says student was murdered.
The theories about what happened to Andrew were going toe-to-toe against each other in the media. Would the ultimate outcome be swayed by public opinion? In this case, would the loudest opinion ultimately become the factual one? If the case of Andrew Weeman seems at all cut and dry to you, there's so much we haven't told you yet. Like the many possible motives that could have been at play, and what Andrew's best friend Scott told investigators when he was interviewed, that he suspected, quote, "Andrew heard something that he shouldn't have within the fraternity."
So stay tuned for part two, where we'll get into how the coroner's office made this surprising determination. And a huge thank you to our first degrees, Megan and Daniel. And of course, they're going to be with us in part two as well. But if you're listening out there and you have a story to tell, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. Follow us on Instagram. Join our Facebook group. We're talking true crime all the time. Join our Patreon if you're looking for more first degree content. And stick around tomorrow. We'll have a brand new episode of Killing Time right in your feed.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers.
And keep your friends close.
But not that close. Shout out to Jared Monaco for scoring original music for The First Degree, producing by Caitlin Cleveland, writing and research by Haley Gray. Sources for this episode are Police Reports, Record, Searchlight, Associated Press, Sacramento Bee, and the National Institutes of Health. And as always, our first degree guest is always our largest source.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.